Look at it this way. Now, you got three choices. One, you chicken out, in that case, I let Ants tie you to the car and drag you around a little bit, and you don't want that, right?
No.
Two, you foul up and Hosteen hears you, and, well, you don't want that, right?
No, I don't.
Three, you are successful, and you join the Pharaohs with a car coat and a blood initiation and all that, huh?
What? Wait a minute. What's blood initiation?
I'm gonna kill myself.
Oh, shit, Howard.
I'm gonna blow my brains out right on the air, right in the middle of the 7 o'clock news.
Get a hell of a rating, I'll guarantee you that. 50 share easy.
You think so?
Sure. We could make a series out of it. Suicide of the week. Why the hell, why limit ourselves? Execution of the week.
Terrorist of the week.
I love it. Suicides. Assassinations. Mad bombers. Mafia hitmen. Automobile smash-ups. The death hour. Great Sunday night show for the whole family.
Hello and welcome back to Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim, and now, fresh from his keynote speaking address at the G20 summit, a man whose connections are so deep, the Ecuadorian embassy in London has his number on speed dial, Teal. How's it going, buddy?
It's going great. I got to say, the G20 loved my keynote on subgenre completionism. That was my keynote to the G20. And I also have watched a lot of movies at the Ecuadorian embassy. They have great home theater there.
I bet they do.
Oh, they really do. It's excellent. And so what I haven't been doing, though, is watching movies that I said I was never going to watch. Sometimes I see a movie and it's so bad, I say, I will never see the sequel. And then sometimes these things happen. So I see that you, I hear you broke down and went and saw a movie that you swore you weren't going
to
see.
No, see, this is where you're wrong. Maybe you'll have to go back to the last episode. I said I didn't really want to see it. This was Fantastic Beasts, Crimes of Grindelwald. Was that his name?
I don't pay attention to this kind of stuff.
I know you don't. So the story is, on Thanksgiving Day, while we're waiting for the big feast, my brother-in-law and his two kids, you know, he wanted to go to the movies and see something. And the one that all the kids agreed on was Fantastic Beasts. So, you know,
of course,
we went to see
the marketing department did their job well in appealing to all four quadrants over the Thanksgiving holiday.
I don't think they did, quite honestly, because the previews, and this should be a telling moment, that if the preview isn't selling you on the film, it's probably not a good film, because my kids were very much like, nah, I don't know if I really want to see this film. But again, it was the consensus vote. There really wasn't a lot out there. I know there was that Wreck-It Ralph, and there was only two people that wanted to see that of the group. So out of the six, Fantastic Beasts won out. We went and saw it. Now, let me just say that out of all the movies in the Harry Potter world, this film is by far the worst, single worst movie they've ever made. Fantastic Beasts, the first one, it seems like a masterwork compared to this.
And I thought it was utter disaster, the first one.
Yeah, I liked it a lot more than you, but I said it was very forgettable. But this film,
yeah,
not a single one of the crowd of six of us, and there's four kids here, liked this movie. We were upset, and my son looked over to me, and he had this angered look on his face when it was over. He said, "Dad, that movie was, that was awful! That was awful!" And he was so outraged.
So I assume that it has no story and is just a random collection of scenes. But what else is wrong with it?
Well, it's the no story that they decided to tell, and all those random scenes are terrible. There is, you know, what is the rule? And I think it's actually something we're going to talk about in a couple minutes. I thought it was William Goldman, the great screenwriter who just passed away. I believe he had a theory that a really good movie has to have three great scenes. Am I correct? Is that him?
Yeah.
So this film has no great scenes. and it's not that I didn't like it. It's just that, like, there's no set pieces.
There's no set pieces?
There's nothing.
See, I just think J.K. Rowling doesn't know how to write a screenplay, and nobody wants to tell her.
J.K. Rowling did write the screenplay, and I agree with you wholeheartedly that this is a major problem. But let's put that aside for a second. All right, we can nitpick all day on the screenplay and the story. Here's a couple of the bottom line problems with this new extension to the Harry Potter world. There's no kids in it. It's a kids movie that focuses on the adults, and I don't think that kids give a rat's ass about what the adults are doing.
No, they like Harry Potter because it's about kids.
You have to tell this story of the world, this wizarding world, through the eyes of children, and that's where the danger and the wonder and all of that stuff comes into play. This adult story, and it's not that interesting.
How many of these movies are they going to make? 8 or 10?
Well, I don't know. This one, I guess, is going to probably make a bag of dough worldwide, but they spend so much of what story they've decided to tell on building up all of these backstories. You know, they've kind of that unfortunate thing with, like, the Star Wars movies do, where they have to spend an entire film trying to tie in all of these little characters that you may have read about in the other books and find a way to tell us how it all happened. But I don't feel that people really care that they have to have all that, and they sacrifice maybe a really good story or adventure to tell this darker tale. Maybe the third movie, where they lead off at the end of the second film, it sounds like, well, maybe the third movie might be good. I think is that if you haven't made a good second movie, then you didn't get to a third. That's the problem. Is don't give me a second movie to set up the third.
I am not going to be watching this movie.
I don't think you should.
I suffered through the first one. It was miserable. I'm not, I can't do that to myself again.
Suffer? That was, look. See, here's the thing. The lead guy there, what's the character's name? The guy,
I don't know. He
collects all the pets. See, I've already forgotten his name. But his character is not very interesting. They use him as this lead guy, but
no,
he has
just on a tour of magic stuff. But he has no character. There's no depth to him. He doesn't even. I'm talking about the first movie. Was just he had no character.
Yeah, but you thought he had a huge character in the first movie compared to this one. he has not. Like, he seems to be an important piece of this film. Like, he's kept the young. I know I sound like a loser for not knowing all these details, but I'm just so enraged by the movie that I've blanked out. But Professor Dumbledore, right? The young is Jude Law.
You've repressed your trauma.
Well, Jude Law is cool as a younger Dumbledore, even though he doesn't get to do anything either.
I think what we need to do is just forget about this movie.
All right. Well, I'm just going to finish the thought. Is that they try to wrap the Fantastic Beast guy into the story, but yet you don't really know why he's so integral. And here's the key. If the movie's called Fantastic Beasts, give us the damn Fantastic Beasts. There's hardly any beasts in the movie. They sprinkle a few here and there, but it says Fantastic Beasts, but there really aren't, it's not about the beasts. And that, I think, is a big problem. And then the second thing, Crimes of Grindelwald, I'm still trying to figure out what the crimes were. Like, it says that, but the movie is really not about the crime. It's the crime is having to have spent $10 on a matinee because I was back where all the multiplexes are, and it's really expensive compared to the hovel that I have here in the sticks, where I only have to pay $7.25.
I think there's a lesson here, though, which is that the wisdom of the family holiday movie-going crowd is wrong.
Well, some years they give us stuff
and you should just. And you should just you just say no to your family. I'm sorry, we can't do this. I know everyone agrees on it, but we're going to have to stay home and talk to each other instead. Well, because as miserable as that may be, it's better than seeing one of these Fantastic Beast movies.
Well, the two wives were smart. They stayed back and did other things. and my wife was a huge Harry Potter fan, but she wanted nothing to do with this. And now I don't think I'll ever see another one again. That's how bad it like just left a stink. I fell asleep briefly. Like, you know, you did that sort of movie doze. I fell asleep a couple times because nothing was happening.
Oh, yeah, the movie doze.
And I was seated next to my niece. And at one point, I'm pretty sure it wasn't because I fell asleep for a moment that I lost thread. I really didn't know what the hell was going on. And I'm a pretty astute movie guy. I turned to her and I said, "Do you know what the heck is happening here?" And she's looking at me and she's like, "I don't know, Uncle James." Okay. So listen, folks, our cinematic world has gotten a little bit smaller over the past few weeks. We've had a few deaths in the movie family, and these are all important figures, mostly through the late 60s, through the 70s and 80s, but they're key people that we've now lost, and the filmmaking world is just not the same. So I'm going to list out a few of the folks, and then mm-hmm. we may talk about some of those movies. The first one is Gloria Katz, the most recent death. She was a screenwriter with her, I think it's her ex-husband. They wrote American Graffiti, and that's one of my all-time favorite movies. And mm-hmm. so, you know, she also co-wrote Howard the Duck. And unfortunately, if you looked her up, they lead off with writer of Howard the Duck. And I, you know, that's a little unfair because American Graffiti is a great film.
Didn't she work on Indiana Jones too?
And the Temple of Doom. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yep. So she you know, yep. she had a long-standing association with George Lucas. I believe that she went to college with him.
That's right. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. And Howard the Duck and Radioland Murders.
Yeah, those are kind of career killers.
They are kind of career killers, yeah.
But I thank her for American Graffiti. And,
yeah.
It's just another loss. Let's see, who do you want to talk about next?
William Gold.
All right. I know he's a favorite of yours, right?
He's a favorite of mine. He, great screenwriter who also wrote this great book called Adventures in the Screen Trade about being a young screenwriter in Hollywood and navigating it and studio notes. And it's a great sort of how-to manual in almost on how to navigate Hollywood. Wrote some great books and movies, Marathon Man, All the President's Men, Princess Bride, Misery. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is what I was about to get to, because as my tribute to William Goldman, I want to just read a little bit from the screenplay of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And so this is early in the film. Butch and Sundance have returned to the hole in the wall gang. They've been out and about. They come back and a guy named Logan, who is just a member of the gang, challenges Butch for leadership of the gang and decision-making ability. And so he says, "I'm going to fight you," basically. Here, I'm starting the script. Butch, moving through the gang toward Logan. He is unarmed and a knife is offered him by one of the gang. Butch, "Not yet. Moving up to Logan now. Not till Harvey and me get all the rules straight." Logan, "Rules? In a knife fight? No rules." As he finishes speaking, Butch delivers the most aesthetically exquisite kick in the balls in the history of the modern American cinema. So that line about that kick in the balls is kind of a famous line in screenwriting circles. The way he addresses both the director and the audience and comes off the page in that way, in a way that the movie going audience is going to witness this, but not get the language of his sentence. That's for the director and the actors trying to deliver this exquisite kick in the balls. And I got to say, in the movie, it's not quite as good as it is in the script. The script really gets your expectations up for this.
No, no, not yet. Not until me and Harvey get the rules straightened out.
Rules? In a knife fight? No rules.
Well, if there ain't going to be any rules, let's get the fight started. Someone count 1, 2, 3, go.
So that's just a little William Goldman moment that I always think about when I think about him. That little half page in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which is a great screenplay in many, many ways. In large part, it starts and continues sort of after the heyday of Butch and Sundance.
Again, as you mentioned, there's a list of films that people obviously have seen that he wrote. There's a score of others that he was a script doctor for that, that probably goes on and on. It's too many to mention. But he did win an Academy Award for his screenplays for Butch, Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men, which that is an amazing adaptation because you're telling a story, and this came out in 1976. So the movie-going audiences who were going to see that film, they knew the story.
We're very familiar. Yeah.
They knew the story of the Watergate break-in, and they read all of the headlines from Woodward and Bernstein, and they, of course, saw the result. However, you've got this movie, and how do you make it suspenseful? How do you take an audience that knows the story and yet for 2+ hours are on the edge of their seat? And I feel that there's a lot to that. The director, Alan,
it's the
screenplay that keeps you really vested in that story.
And this is a great example of what J.K. Rowling isn't doing.
Ouch. See, now we're picking on poor J.K. Rowling.
Well, William Goldman is one of the great screenwriters. He knew what he was doing. He could put movies together. This is why he was such a great script doctor, too. He would just come in and fix people's screenplays over and over and over again. He got paid like $1 million a script to come in and fix them. So it's, yes, it's not a fair comparison. He did that Invisible Man movie with Paul Verhoeven.
No.
Which he's uncredited on.
Nope, you got it wrong, buddy.
Oh, I do?
Yes. You're thinking Memoirs of an Invisible Man, which was John Carpenter.
Well, I know that.
And Chevy Chase. Paul Verhoeven did, and then maybe he also worked on that, but Paul Verhoeven did that weird movie where they make the guy invisible and he like goes off and on a rapist rampage.
Yes, that's the one I'm thinking about.
Yeah, did he write
that? What was that called?
Call bad, because people like to pick on Dream Girls or what was that movie
Hollow Man, that's what it's called.
Hollow Man, yes. It's creepy. Great special effects, but it's creepy. And I actually have a soft spot the other Invisible Man movie. It really is a pretty good story.
I agree, yeah. Again, William Goldman. Now, here's my one little knock on William Goldman. Not the greatest director.
What did he direct?
Didn't he direct Year of the Comet?
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Oh, no, Peter Yates directed it.
Yeah, okay, because you're, and I always get confused. It's not that sort of 80s schlock film Night of the Comet.
He wrote a movie called The Year of the Comet, and for some reason I thought he directed it.
All right, I do have a sort of little admission on the William Goldman front.
Yes.
And this is going to be controversial, but I...
Wait, you've never seen The Ghost in the Darkness?
No, that's not the controversy. No.
I'm joking.
I know, but that's not the controversy. The controversy is that while for many people is known for The Princess Bride, it's not a film that I particularly enjoy.
Wow. What do your kids think of it?
They thought it was all right. We kind of had to force our oldest to watch it. I know, again, so many people, they love it. And I do recognize and respect all the great lines that William Goldman wrote. And it's based on his book. It's a favorite of so many people. It's just
favorite. Yeah.
It's not one of mine. I like it. It's okay. It's not one of my favorite movies. I myself have not seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid for a very long time. I do remember seeing it when I was maybe 14 or 15 and loving it. loving it. But yeah. Do you think that a
I've
lot
seen
of kids...
it several times in the last 5 years.
Did today's kids know about it? I don't know.
Well, I showed it to some millennials. I showed it to some millennials at one point.
Was this at the Ecuadorian embassy?
At the Ecuadorian embassy. I had a screening of Butch Cassidy, invited some millennials, and they loved it.
See, I think this is what this program's all about. We're trying to introduce people to some movies that.
Yeah. So
it's not just like, oh, I got to see this film. It's like, if you see this film, you're going to love it.
Yeah. So if I was saying William Goldman to somebody, I would say Butch Cassidy, All the President's Men, Princess Bride, if you haven't seen it, we can disagree on this, and
Marathon Man. I think people should see The Princess Bride if you haven't seen it. I mean, it is a classic. Yeah. Just because I wasn't, you know, in love with the movie, I recognize that it is in its place in history as a classic.
Yes. Okay.
All right, moving on.
So, William Goldman is worth a short binge, I think.
Yep. And you know what? There's going to be no more new William Goldman works. So
it's true.
This is it. Now you got to have to go to the history. And, you know, speaking of history, here's another name. And I think in film circles, people, you know this person. I have worshipped this person's work for years. It's sad that he's gone because, again, we will have no more new works from him. Is a man named Pablo Ferro.
And, yeah,
I will tell you how I first got to know the name Pablo Ferro. There are two films that are in my personal arsenal of just movies that I love. And it's not about their stories. It's just about this atmosphere of cool that they just ooze from the screen. And one is the Thomas Crown Affair and Bullet, both Steve McQueen vehicles. And the key is the open. In an amazing way, there's just a kaleidoscope of images, multi-screen use. Bullet has one of the coolest opening five-minute segments I've ever seen on film.
Yes.
And it's all about the credit sequence and how it was put together. And in these films, it was listed that the title sequences created by Pablo Ferro. And once I got that name, when I'd see films that had a very distinctive look from the credits or a specific sequence, whose name would pop up but Pablo Ferro.
Yeah. So he was sort of like a montage expert too, right?
Yes. And so in Thomas Crown Affair, they were looking for a way to speed up the action. For those who aren't familiar with the original, not the Pierce Brosnan one, which is actually not bad in its own right, but
is actually decent. Yeah.
It's just about the Thomas Crown Affair original for me is just everything that I thought was cool about a film, but
yes.
They needed to get this bank heist moving faster. And they came up with an idea. The editor was the great director, Hal Ashby.
Yes.
And he worked with Pablo Ferro on an idea of this multi-camera look that they would have to put together in editing. And they did this multi-screen effect where you'd see
five
or six different images of the action. And sometimes it would only be one or two little panels on the screen and the rest would be black. And it was starting to edit to the music and it was building a suspense and it was just really awesome. And as a kid seeing this film, I had never seen a movie that did something like that before.
Yeah, I think it was really forward-thinking and experimental.
And, of course, I didn't know this at the time, but he was already working on these types of sequences, like opening credit sequences, for another filmmaking hero of mine, Stanley Kubrick.
Yep.
And Dr. Strangelove, the very famous look of the credits.
Yes, that opening title sequence.
Yes, with the fueling of the jets in midair.
Which is so, the fueling of the jets, the Freudian fueling of the jets.
And that was him. That was Pablo Ferro came up with that.
Yeah. And sort of the whole anarchic spirit of that movie is captured just even in the font.
Well, that's the thing, is that iconic font, which he then recreated for other directors who also wanted that look. He did the credits in the 90s for Addams Family and Men in Black.
That's right.
He wasn't done with Kubrick, not by a long shot. He created the credits for A Clockwork Orange. And then in the genius of his marketing, because he did a lot of commercial work, he created what many film scholars would argue is one of the greatest 1-minute film trailers of all time. And that was for the trailer of A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it was the...
Okay, I didn't know he had done that. Wow.
He did. Kubrick wanted him to create something that would really... It was a very hard film to try to sell based on the content. So how do you...
you think?
How do you capture that in a trailer? And he took stock photo images, images from the movie, all sped up, and then with those color titles in between, it just...
Yes.
It was almost a very subliminal message campaign. And that's great. And then his relationship with Hal Ashby continued, and he did the credit sequences for several of his movies in the 70s, Harold and Maude, Being There, Bound for Glory.
I've never seen Bound for Glory.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, well, you are certainly no Hal Ashby completionist now, are you?
Well, I will be now.
Bound for Glory, you know, that's a great film, but... For some reason, I think people just want to, not to dismiss it, but sort of say, well, do I really want to sit there and watch this movie about Woody Guthrie? And I will tell you, yes, yes, you do. You do want to sit there. It has amazing cinematography by Haskell Wexler, who was an Academy Award winner.
Yeah.
And there are sequences that will blow your mind in it. And it's a really great story about this man who traveled the country and, you know, tried to help unions in the early part of the 20th century.
So who else died recently?
I know, there's a lot. Okay, filmmaker, somewhat controversial. A lot of people probably haven't seen most of his films. He really didn't make a lot of features after 1990. Nicholas Roeg, he was a cinematographer. Yeah. And then he became a director.
Yeah, very interesting cinematographer. Some interesting films.
Well, he started as an assistant camera, and he was an assistant camera on a very famous film called Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
And then his work was so prominent in that film that the director, David Lean, tasked him to shoot his next film, Dr. Zhivago. But they had disagreements on set.
But it didn't quite work out that way.
Yes, David Lean felt that Nicholas Roeg thought he was too stodgy and old-fashioned, and so he fired Nicholas Roeg.
You can see how that would be a conflict, though, because Roeg is kind of a maverick, right? He experiments...
Well, you know, it's funny because to finish up with his cinematography, he went on and he shot Fahrenheit 451 for Truffaut.
Yep.
And he shot like a low budget film that looked amazing as Mask of the Red Death.
Yep.
Then he did costume movies, Far from the Madding Crowd, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And then he had this breakout. It was one of his like last cinematography efforts that he didn't lens himself and direct. Was Petulia. And I don't know if you've ever seen that film.
Love that movie.
It's got these amazing, amazing compositions.
Well, I have to say, I am a Richard Lester completionist. And at some point in the future, we will talk, we'll do a whole show on Richard Lester.
I am in, buddy. I am in. And I, you know, it's funny, what finally got me to the Petulia table was the fact that Nicholas Roeg shot it. Because I had sat there, it was on one day, and I was watching, and I was like, This movie is strange, but man, who is shooting this film? It looks incredible. And so, you know, as Hollywood comes a-knocking, they said, well, let's give this guy a shot and at directing. And he co-directed his first film, and he made this movie called Performance, which almost banished him from ever making a film again, because it within 5 minutes, kids, 5 minutes, you are going to know that this movie was directed by someone who was not going to make normal movies, because in that first 5 minutes, you're either in or you're way out.
Way out. And if you're out, you're probably out for the rest of the Nick Rogue filmography.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I don't know if he ever made anything as controversial as the first few minutes of Performance. However, he made a film, Don't Look Now, which for years had so much controversy about a very infamous sex scene.
Hugely controversial and affected the movie's distribution.
Yeah, the movie was not well received for years, and then it's one of those films that after 20 or so years became regarded as a horror classic.
It is a horror classic, and not a horror classic, but his next film after Don't Look Now was The Man Who Fell to Earth, which is considered a sci-fi classic.
Yeah, and that, in typical Nicholas Rogue style, it's a hard watch. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. And it doesn't really follow a standard narrative.
Nope.
And one thing that is very, very clear from his first film Performance all down the line through almost every film he made is his editing style. He is the master of the cross cut, the jump cut. He mixes his narrative up. I was watching just literally a month or so ago before he passed, was Walkabout.
Yes.
And again, he starts to chop up the editing, and he's basically saying, yeah, you know how these narratives go. You can figure it out. Just stay with me. I don't need to show you all of this stuff. He does something towards the end of that film that I thought was very, very fascinating. These two kids that they get stuck out in the outback. Their father takes them out there, and he commits suicide, and they were just sort of stranded on their own. And an Aborigines boy who's going on his adult manhood walkabout, he stumbles upon them and he kind of takes them in and rescues them. But towards the end of the film, there's not really a big rescue moment for the two kids, but it suddenly cross cuts.
Right.
And you see the eldest girl, who was a teenager. She's suddenly in this tiny little suburban kitchen, fixing a dinner, smoking a cigarette, waiting for her husband to come home. And you don't really see her. And then you realize it's her, and that he's showing that they had this really epic adventure that you think might have changed their lives forever. And sometime in the future, she's just a housewife. And there's no other comment on it, but he'll do that. He'll throw these scenes in, and he cuts them into like very strange narratives.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched just last week, I watched Bad Timing for my Nick Rogue memorial. And it's a movie that suffers because it stars Art Garfunkel.
Yeah, I've watched some of it, not all of it, and he is not the best performance, let's just put it that way.
It's not the best performance, and the movie suffers because of it, but really interesting editing style. The narrative is all over the place. Scenes put next to each other for emotional logic, not necessarily script logic or dramatic logic. So really interesting. Nick Rogue is interesting, difficult to watch. I can't recommend that people run out and watch his movies, except for one. There's one that I feel like is really accessible.
It's probably the one that you'd never guess he directed.
Yes.
The Witches?
The Witches, exactly. You would never guess he directed it. It's his most accessible movie. It's good for kids, I think. It's scary.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, great movie.
He made that, I believe, because he wanted to have a movie that his kids could watch.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
Yeah, it shows you that this guy, I almost wish that he had made some more mainstream films, only because he could clearly do anything. I mean, the movie is great, and it shows none of the weird editing that he was known for. But it's a great movie. It's just really not indicative of what his portfolio offers.
Right. No, it's not indicative. It's an oddball film in his filmography.
Just because somebody might be an important filmmaker, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're somebody that, you know, I enjoy or you enjoy, but I think that Nicholas Roeg is, I think he's important.
No, he's a really important part of cinema history, and I think was very influential in a lot of ways for a lot of different filmmakers.
And speaking of filmmakers who have passed, we have another one we've got to talk about.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we do. It's a good old Italian film master, Bernardo Bertolucci, a guy who won an Academy Award for The Last Emperor. It was a large, beautiful, very slow epic. That's one of the things about Bernardo Bertolucci. His films can be painfully slow.
They can be. If you get into the cinematography, but you have to have some patience.
Yeah, I mean, not all of his films, but a good portion were lensed by the great Vittorio Storaro. And the two of them were very in sync with creating an amazing look. One of the greatest color photographed films that I've ever seen.
That's the Conformist.
Yeah, and that's not just about nature scenes. I mean, there's a look that is established in this film that it really pales beyond compare. It's a stunner.
It is a stunner, and it's the cinematography, the lighting, the set design, and the costumes are all working together in a really interesting way.
Yeah, and The Conformist out of all his films is definitely my favorite.
Yes, me too.
I think it's also timely in these intriguing times. It's a movie that maybe people should take a look at. I actually liked some of his later work. I liked Stealing Beauty, and I'm a big fan of The Dreamers.
I have not seen The Dreamers, but I did like Stealing Beauty.
Yep. I mean, it's definitely not up to some of his epics, but I liked Stealing Beauty and The Dreamers. That's just a very cool movie, and you can see a lot of the interesting touches that a cinema genius as Bernardo Bertolucci was.
Right.
Now here it is. This is the bomb.
Okay.
Last Tango in Paris.
Yeah. Last Tango in Paris, which is one of his most famous films.
And it's definitely his most controversial. And I think that for anybody who, you know, was born, say, even after 1980. This movie, since day one, was controversial. It caused a controversial sensation in theaters at the time. People flocked to it because it was notorious, because in the early 70s, when, you know, the rating system was very new, only a few years, you had filmmakers suddenly making movies
pushed the envelope.
Yeah, with sexuality.
Yeah.
And subject
matter. And violence.
And violence. And this movie has sexual violence. And it's not a laughing matter, of course, but, you know, the controversy has been reignited over the years. I think it started probably with a lot of people that never saw the film. It's not a movie that's... I saw it when I was 14, probably because I heard it's a very controversial movie. I found it kind of dull, and I didn't really enjoy it, I got to be honest, because I was too young for it. And it's not really meant to be an enjoyable experience.
It's not an enjoyable movie.
No, it's a downer. It's complex, though. And a few years ago, before she passed away of cancer, the leading actress...
Maria Schneider.
Yeah. She had given an interview that was somewhat, you know, misconstrued sort of in the grapevine. A lot of people got confused over what she said, but the letter of it was that there's a rape scene in the film It's a very notorious. And she wasn't physically actually raped, but she felt that the experience of doing the scene was like a rape to her, because she felt that what took place on the actual scene was a last minute decision by the director and Marlon Brando, the actor. And if you can think about it, she's 19 on a film set by two very powerful men. She probably was in a position where she felt like she couldn't say no.
Well, but also they kind of agreed on something and didn't tell her because they didn't think she was a good enough actress to get the reaction they wanted.
Yeah,
so they didn't tell her what was going to happen.
And I think that's where you have to look at, you know, a betrayal, because you're, whether you're an actor or actress, you're on a set, you're doing a job. This is not
and
supposed
you're putting
to be
your
real.
Trust in these. Yeah, you are doing a job, and you don't need to be tricked into actually being scared or actually being violated. You're but right. I think it, there's the controversy around this is justified. I think it. I think it really stains the film and Bertolucci's resume to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, so what do you do? The man is no longer with us. The film is out there, and I will never shy away from controversy. I think that sometimes the best way to head off this controversy, you got to see it. You can talk about it and you can be outraged, but I think it helps. I did rewatch that scene recently because I knew we'd probably talk about this. And I wanted to just put the context into what the scene entails, because, you know, my imagination, and this is what happens, you start to think, well, what did they really show in that scene? Like, and compared to things that are on TV today, from a visual standpoint, people might be surprised that there's really no nudity in that particular scene.
Yeah,
it is very simulated. I don't think for a minute anything really actually happened there. But
unlike the scene in Don't Look Now.
Yes, but I've watched that scene a lot too, and you know what? That was simulated as well. There was no real sex. You want to see real sex in a movie, you can watch In the Realm of the Senses, which has so much unstimulated sex that I don't think you'll ever need to watch a sex scene again. But there was a film, right, which was very controversial. There was a lot of things going on in there. However, that was very carefully planned with the actors and the director and very consensual.
That's the issue with Last Tango in Paris.
Yes, is that, you know, you're going to do a brutal scene like that. You should make sure your actor and actress are both on board and not to get a shock reaction, because what she was saying is that there was an emotional scar that kind of stayed with her for the rest of her life. So,
well, yes.
You know, so there it is. So, I mean, you know, films should be just films, but when they bring themselves into the realm of the real, you know, it can be
complicated.
Yeah. So anyways, that's been a real downer of a conversation. You know, we've got technical issues today. We've got dead filmmakers.
We've got the death hour.
Yeah. What can you do to lift us up before we part our ways today?
Man, what can I do to lift us up? You know what? I saw a movie that you recommended.
Okay.
I went and watched a movie that you told me to check out called Sing Street.
Oh, yes.
This is a great coming-of-age story about 15-year-old in Ireland in the 80s, and I think it's 1986. And he has a crush on a girl, so he starts a band to impress her and get her to be in his music videos and stuff. And it's this great 80s band, and he goes through all these musical evolutions and style evolutions based on the different bands he's into. And it's just, it's a great coming of age story, a great love story, and really uplifting. And the songs are great. The songs were written for the movie, all original songs, and they're great. They tell the story, they add to the story. They're not just, you know, pop songs plugged in there for soundtrack. So this is a great little movie, a getting the band together kind of movie. So thank you for recommending it. Yeah, I would recommend other people see it. It's a feel-good movie.
Well, now I'm relieved because because if you didn't like Sing Street, this episode was going to get ugly.
I have one problem with it.
Okay.
and I won't describe it because I don't want to ruin it for people, but I didn't like the last shot of the film. It's a pet peeve of mine.
A lot of people, believe it or not, have actually taken issue with the very, very end. Some of it's confusion. I've seen the movie now three full times and partially a fourth, and the ending does seem to make a little bit more sense when I've seen it repeatedly. But the first reaction I had was the very end, as you're talking about, it was a little confusing. So I think that is a little bit of flaw. The film was directed by John Carney, who was a singer and a musician in the band The Frames, and he directed Once, which a lot of people love, and Begin Again, which isn't as well known. It's not as good as Once, but there's some moments.
I did not see it.
I liked it. We won't really talk about that, but it's, you know, he does this thing. It's not the same movie over and over again, but he likes the idea of people coming together and making music together. And he does that with Once, and there's a great scene in Once where the two main characters are going to record. They've gotten some money together, and they're musicians together, and they got some studio rented, and you can see the look on the engineer's face that it's another band trying to make a buck, and great, all right, whatever, it's never going to go anywhere. But what happens is they start to play. And the engineer wakes up and he realizes these people have something. And now he gets into it and the whole scene builds and you actually feel the excitement that making music can do.
Exactly. And that coming together of different people coming together, bringing their own creativity into it, having it build into something meaningful in the movie. And yeah, that excitement of creativity. And there's so many scenes like that in Sing Street.
Well, that's the thing. So he's able to bring that magic in for another moment in Begin Again. But Sing Street, he really pulls it together. He's very successful. It to me, it reminded me a lot of like a sort of a minier version of The Commitments, which is another film that I love. I must love these band movies.
Wait, are you in making the band subgenre completionist? subgenre alert. I hear it coming.
We've now entered the realm of the subgenre. Making a band.
Making the band.
You know, there are a lot of movies.
Get the band together.
There are a lot
of movies. Yeah, yeah. What are some of your favorites?
Well, I get one kind of theme through most of these films. Is there's sort of that young, go-getting spirit that music can conquer anything if we can just get a band. So Commitments.
That rebellious spirit of getting a band together and somehow that will create justice and peace in the world. And it kind of does in Sing Street, literally. Like,
I will throw out some films that might not.
Yeah, throw out some films.
So there's one that just came out this year that I want to see, but it's not sort of available for free on demand yet, is Hearts Beat Loud. That's a film about a guy's got a record store in Brooklyn, and that's kind of that's in trouble, and he's got a daughter that he's, you know, I think the mom must be dead or something, and she's getting ready to go to college, and they record something together and it goes viral, and now he's trying to convince her that they should start a band. So I kind of want to see that.
Okay, that's cool.
There's a movie from a few years ago that David Chase, the director and creator of The Sopranos.
Oh, yes.
Not Fade Away.
Yes.
And that is a sort of
Not Fade Away.
It's not a great movie, but it's a very interesting film. It's kind of like a great first movie for him to make. And it's about a group of kids in the late 60s, early 70s that are trying to like put together kind of a garage band to really impress girls. And it's a coming of age story. So that's an interesting one.
Which is impressing girls may be a running theme in some of these movies.
All right. Well, I'm going to throw a different one at you. It's not easy to find. And I only watched it a few years ago for the first time, but it's Notorious. Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Haven't seen it.
Oh. It's good. It's actually, it has a lot in common with another movie from around the same time called Times Square.
Okay.
It's almost like that. It's like a perfect double feature, but it does involve a band getting put together called The Stains. And it's a sort of band against, it's a band against authority.
Which many of them are.
Do you got a few? I got a list, but you tell me some.
School of Rock.
That's great. And my oldest has seen that and he loved it.
Yeah, mine too. And she loved it. And it's a great rock and roll rebel, getting the band together and coming of age.
The Rocker. That's
the Rocker.
It's got Rainn Wilson. And he...
Oh, that's right. I never saw this.
Oh,
yeah, that's right.
Like, that reminds me of like School of Rock, where he's kicked out of a band, but then he sees in some high school teenagers his chance to get back in. And it kind of reminds me of Jack Black looking at this classroom as his opportunity to make a band, because they just want to play music. That's what these people really want to do. They don't want to be famous. They just want to play music.
Yes. Rock and roll spirit. How about Eddie and the Cruisers? Yeah. I have not seen that since the 80s.
Okay. I have a lot of knowledge on the Eddie and the Cruisers. This one's a tough one because it's told in flashback.
Yeah.
And so Eddie was already established, and then he, you know, they go tell the story, and I guess it's sort of a making the band movie, but it's on the outskirts.
Yes, it is. It's on the fringes of the subgenre.
But it's a film that, wait a minute. I'm not done with Eddie, buddy.
Oh, yeah. No, let's stay on Eddie and the Cruisers. Because I loved this movie when I was a kid.
So it's one of those films where the great Michael Paré, he was trying to establish himself as a movie star. And he made these films, Eddie and the Cruisers, which was a total bomb. I was like, who wants to see that movie? Then it comes a year later, it shows up on HBO, and it's just one of those movies that's on for the summer, and you're watching it, and then you watch it again, and 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 you just can't stop watching this movie. And he also made a movie, it's not a making of the band movie, but there's a band in it, and it's another one of my favorites, Streets of Fire, which has... what's
Michael Paré?
Yeah, and Ellen Aim and the Attackers is the group, and it's played by. What's her name?
Walter Hill directed it.
Yes,
right?
But who's her name? What, the actress?
Diane Lane.
Yes, who was also the lead actress in The Fabulous Stains. We're coming around full circle, people. Stay with me. Stay with me. That Thing You Do.
Okay. Yeah, That Thing You Do.
That's actually, that's a great movie about a one-hit wonder band. I mean, it really is the way things were. Many bands got one hit, and then that was it.
Okay, a couple other starting the band movies. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Okay, it's not a starting band movie. It's not a starting band movie, but it has some great starting the band stuff in it.
I have seen that listed on the internet as one, but I mean, it is great. The Soggy Bottom Boys, but
okay. Here's one you won't find listed on the internet. It's not a making the band movie, but it has probably one of my favorite making the band sequences. Is the 5-hour cut of Wim Wenders Until the End of the World. There's a little bit of the making of the band stuff in the 2-hour cut, the U.S. cut. But in the long cut, it's this amazing sequence. All these people are together in the Australian outback, and they all sort of just start picking up instruments and joining in. And it's kind of going on in the background. And then they all sort of come together and play the Kinks song Days, with didgeridoos and just kind of any instrument that's around.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's a great and it all takes maybe 45 minutes of this kind of going on in the background. That same thing you were just talking about with that excitement of the song and sort of how that can emotionally grab you in a movie.
I've wanted to see this 5-hour cut of that film for years.
Yes, I've seen it 3 times.
I've seen it 0 times. It's not available, but yet you, of course, you know, you have the ins to the Ecuadorian embassy, so I get it.
Yes. Wim Wenders came to the Ecuadorian embassy and showed it there.
Wow.
It was special screening. Yeah.
I guess we're going to have to end on this in a few seconds here, but Garage Days, I've only seen parts of. I didn't really like it, but that's from director Alex Proyas. That's another Making the Band film.
Did not see it, yeah. Okay. Interesting little subgenre, though.
Yeah. You know, I if you haven't seen some of those movies, check them out. If you like that subgenre, I happen to be a fan of that subgenre.
Me too. I like it when people come together and make music in movies. I'm a sucker for it. And so I totally fell for Sing Street. I highly recommend Sing Street to anyone who has feelings.
Yeah, you know, my story of seeing that is I'd heard about it, and it was not playing anywhere near me because I lived out in the sticks, unfortunately. And unless it's a horror movie or an action movie, they don't play it. But when it came out on Netflix, for a long time it was on Netflix.
Yeah.
I saw that, and it was right after the 2016 election. And let's just say Sing Street was a great pick-me-up.
Yeah,
it really was.
And it is. Yeah, no, I mean, really, like, if you're a bitter, twisted cynic, you probably won't like this movie, but everyone else will enjoy it.
My kids both love it. And it's probably the very first movie that my 10-year-old kind of has taken under his wing as sort of his, oh, this is this great movie that I know about that no one else does. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah, and my 6-year-old will actually quote parts of the film. He'll walk around going, "Rock and roll is a risk. You risk being ridiculed." And to hear a 6-year-old say that is pretty funny. He loves it. And then we listen to the soundtrack all the time. The songs are so good.
The songs are really good. Yeah.
Part about the songs is that it through this story,
the story is told through the song. Well, he's writing these songs to the girl in a way.
But he's getting a musical education. His older brother is the one that keeps feeding him. And as his music tastes get more complicated and complex, the songs start to be influenced by those complexities. And they get stronger and better. And you can hear the influences. So there's this dueling soundtrack of the soundtrack that he's listening to and the kind of songs he does. And it's so brilliant how this the writer, director, John Carney, was able to write songs that actually sound like something you might have heard in the 80s.
Yes, and that might have been written by a teenager.
Yeah, I really feel it's underrated in those respects. It's a great film. There's a lot going on in it. And I challenge someone to see it and not like it. They can write to us at feedback@jimandjill.com.
Yeah, please write to us if you don't like this film, and we will give you a talking to.
There'll be a scolding.
You will be admonished.
So, you know, we could go on for hours, but we won't. We make that commitment to you, the listener, to try to keep it under an hour. That's just our pledge to you. Yep. So there'll be some clever editing to get rid of some of the fumbles of this episode
and the technical difficulties.
Yeah, and, you know, those challenges will happen. The internet is not infallible.
It's true.
Lest anyone thinks that we were talking in the same room, which I know it sounds like it's so intimate, but perhaps we are using technology beyond the ways of man. All right. I'm going to wrap this up.
Okay. Let's wrap it up.
All right. Later, everybody.
Bye-bye.
That was bad, bad music. And there is nothing as bad in this world as bad music.
You know, you can record over tape.
No. That was a novelty act. You want to have actual sexual intercourse, right?
Yeah. What?
The girl. It's all about the girl, isn't it?
Yeah, the girl, yeah.
And you're going to use somebody else's art to get her? Are you kidding?
We're just starting. We need to learn how to play.
Do the Sex Pistols know how to play? You don't need to know how to play. Who are you, Steely Dan? You need to learn how not to play, Connor. That's the trick. That's rock and roll. And that takes practice. And you're not a covers band, by the way.
Really?
No. Every school has a covers band. Every pub has a covers band. Every wedding has a covers band. And every covers band has a middle-aged member who'll never know whether they could have made it in the music industry or not because they never had the balls to write a song for someone else. Rock and roll is a risk. You risk being ridiculed.
But I don't know how to write a song.
Close that door and sit down.
Really?
It's going to be a long night.
I have school in the morning.
This is school.